Welcome back to the High Tech Forum podcast. I'm your host, Richard Bennett. And today we've got a special guest who's been with us a couple of times before. That's Professor Dave Farber, who is widely known as the grandfather of the Internet because he, as a university professor, taught the people who made the fundamental technical contributions to the Internet. And hello, Dave.
Hello. Glad to be back.
Yeah, I always enjoy talking to you. There's this issue in the news, net neutrality. It's come up again. I thought we'd settled it two or three times before, but the FCC has a meeting on Thursday in which they're going to vote on a notice of proposed rulemaking that apparently intends to revise the legal foundation of net neutrality by taking it away from Title II and returning it to the Title I classification that net neutrality regulations, to the extent that we've ever had them in the United States, how it was implemented. So do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I've always felt that the Title II was a mistake, given you wanted to that your objective was to do something about what net neutrality, whatever that is. Maybe I should comment first that the term net neutrality basically it became sort of a buzzword. It's very hard for anybody to define what the devil is meant by it. And in fact, it's sort of in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah, Bob Kahn, who's one of the two chief architects of the Internet, calls it a slogan.
Yeah, it's a slogan, and I think Dave Clark was quoted as saying, hell, the network was never designed to be neutral.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's true. Said something about funny little bunny rabbit dreams of a Internet that never was.
Yeah. Most of the stories that have been used to motivate this political discussion or hype discussion of net neutrality even dealt with activities that the FCC rapidly caused to stop happening. There were a couple of cases where they came and talked to the carriers and said, you shouldn't do that. And that's quite often quite enough to stop.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much what happened in the Comcast incident. That was the first really big, high visibility net neutrality controversy that the FCC took up. That it took the FCC about a year to get through the inquiry and the order, but 6 months into it, Comcast discontinued the practice that the advocates were complaining about anyway.
Yeah, and there have been a number of cases like that, all under the old rules. So the negative, so Title II brings some problems that I thought were better left alone. One of my favorite problems is it took the jurisdiction of the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, away from dealing with anything to do with the Internet,
mm-hmm.
because they're specifically prohibited from dealing with common carriers.
Yeah, they have responsibility for the privacy regulations of the Internet edge services companies like Google and Facebook and what have you, as well as general antitrust authority and authority to bring actions against companies engaging in anti-competitive conduct, which I thought was the foundation. I thought that was actually the point of net neutrality, was that it was a kind of a technical means of ensuring that there would never be any anti-competitive conduct on the Internet. Don't think it can actually do that, but some of the early papers indicate that was the hope.
Yeah, maybe it's the hope, but it's very hard to stop that. And usually it's by the time you actually get to recognize the problem. Well, let me back up for a minute. The other problem is that you have to be careful to distinguish between anti-competitive activities and innovation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a company can do something in an innovative way, which some people would interpret to be anti-competitive, but isn't. For instance, You know, if I produce a much, much better computer than my than other companies that I compete with, is that anti-competitive?
Well, it gives you an advantage in the marketplace. The question
gives
is,
me a big advantage.
Yeah,
in the
but
marketplace.
The question is whether, you know, whether that's fair, whether what did is fair, and that's sort of hard to know without evaluating the specific facts around, you know, why your computer is better and how you figured it out, right? I mean, I think that gets to the objection I have with a priori banning certain technical practices, because the technical practice, I think it, whether it's fair or anti-competitive or not, depends on how it's used, depends on the behavior. It's not, you know, you can't sort of look into the genetic structure of a lawbreaker and determine that, you know, that they have to be locked up before they've done anything wrong. You have to, you know, you have to do something wrong first.
That's correct. And you don't want to minimize the ability to innovate.
Mm-hmm.
Nor do you want to stop the regulatory mechanisms from saying you've gone too far.
Yeah, I mean, it should be a back and forth, right? I mean, because
this
is really the thing that probably disturbs me the most in this entire debate is the notion that the overreaching goal of the kind of regulation that's been formulated under the name net neutrality, a lot of it is about keeping the internet the way it is. And
yes.
that's not an appropriate goal in a technical marketplace. It's certainly... I mean, in our careers as engineers, I mean, we probably never worked on a project that was aimed at keeping things the way they were.
No, in fact, most of our effort was making sure that things changed dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
And,
but,
you know,
just so the mere fact of change is suspicious in today's marketplace or in regulatory scenario anyway.
And it's very, very difficult to say in advance whether many of the changes are, quote, anti-competitive or whether they are innovative and other people will track it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem. Once you get hazy in that area, all you're asking for is endless lawsuits and people are going to have to pre-check before they do anything.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's one of the problems of the regulatory overhang. If you're a smart company and you're in a highly regulated environment like Title II puts you in, then before you do anything, what's a wise move? You quietly go down to Washington and spend a couple of months or maybe years convincing, you know, making sure that you're not going to get beat up or making sure that you can use that to beat up other people. There's a lot of games there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That slows down innovation enormously.
Well, just the fact that companies are spending money on lobbyists, you know, rather than on engineers, I mean, that's symptomatic of the problem there.
Yeah. We agree.
Yeah. And so the specific, you know, the status quo that we had prior to February 2015, when the FCC passed the current open internet order, was that the Federal Trade Commission had a big role in privacy, and they had developed a fairly permissive, many people, I think, believe their rules are a little bit too permissive, but they had the benefit of being uniformly applied. So you had the same regulations or the same standards of conduct anyway that applied to, you know, Google and Facebook, who are the duopoly basically in internet advertising, and those same rules would apply to ISPs. And of course, none of the ISPs are really into the advert or the privacy marketplace yet, are they?
Not directly, although all of them would like a piece of the action.
And that probably motivates some of the acquisitions we've seen, like Verizon,
yes.
Gobbling up AOL and Comcast going after the television broadcasters, and so they're kind of moving outside their little subscriber funded niche into it's a revenue scenario that's really a lot like newspapers. The way newspapers function today is, you know, you want to read the New York Times online, you have to pay a subscription fee to get more than like 5 articles a month. And so even though you're paying your subscription fee, they're also shoving ads in your face.
Yeah. And there's this sort of underpinning of ads that seem to go across many, many services. So they get revenue from it.
Mm-hmm.
And the carrot people like Comcast and Verizon do not want to be stuck only being carriers that pass bits. They want a piece of the action that goes there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the attempts to do that other ways have always sort of not worked. There have been other ideas of how to derive revenue from the bits that travel past you, but they're not very effective ways of doing it. The easiest way of doing it is to try to get into a business relationship with the people who collect the money, so you can get part of that action. Yeah. And the way we tend to do that is to buy them.
Yeah, they do a little bit of the sponsored data, free data, zero rating stuff, where, or at least are trying to explore that.
They're trying
to. Yeah.
But
not a big, it's not a big piece of their action at this point at all.
Well, part of the problem there is that when that first came up, people were screaming, that's against net neutrality.
Right.
And so, again, do you want to go into that battle? I happen to think zero rating or whatever that's, and its descendants is not a bad idea.
Well, it's something, I mean, there are analogs to it in a lot of respectable marketplaces. I mean, 800 numbers and...
800 numbers are that.
Coupons.
Coupons, free newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
free
samples. I'm walking out of a train station in Manhattan, and you have this selection of free newspapers. Basically, they're carrying ads. And you get the item free, but in fact, you're being exposed to news and ads, and that's all over the place. So, when that first was proposed, there were big screams about that violating net neutrality. I think that sort of caused people to back off a little bit and take it easy.
It says a lot about how amorphous the term net neutrality is, that it can be applied to a practice that was not even part of the discussion for the first 5 or 10 years when net neutrality was on the table.
Right.
But it just, here's something new. Must be a net neutrality violation until you can prove otherwise.
If I don't like it, I'll accuse it of being a violation of net neutrality. Yeah. If I like it, I'll keep my mouth shut. And that's basically the theme in back of it.
Well, and aside from the uniformity stuff, the Federal Trade Commission has some enforcement powers that the FCC doesn't have, right?
Yes. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but the one thing that they do have that I was involved at the FCC in the AOL Time Warner merger. And, the FCC got into that by just the fact that I think AOL had some licenses. Now, very weak handle, very, very weak handle. The Federal Trade Commission had a major interest in it, and they had this weapon in their hands if necessary, if they could use it. They could bring antitrust.
Yeah.
Actions. Mm-hmm. They and the Justice Department are the two that can do antitrust. Now, you don't do that lightly, but in fact, companies worry about the FTC a lot.
Uh-huh. Well, and that's one of those things. I remember at the time that was going down, a lot of our friends in the public interest side of the equation were really up in arms about it, and they thought it was going to have horrible consequences for the internet, the American economy, and free speech. And I think most of us that are more tech-oriented just thought, well, it's ridiculous and it's going to fail, and so there's not really, there's not significant synergies between these companies. So, let it fail. And sure enough.
I was on the group that had Honcho, the FCC's examination on that. And I remember talking to one of the major guys in the AOL time, one of those people. And I said, it's not going to work.
Right.
You know? And they went ahead. And in fact, it worked in the sense that it certainly raised the value of the stock for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And so depending on how you look, whether that's a success or not, but there was no reason to believe, as far as we could tell, that you had two incompatible cultures being crammed together, and that just was not going to work. But you know, that was not our job to run their companies. Our job was just to make sure that they didn't violate the laws and the regulations.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, just as a little aside, if you look back at that, there's something that people have forgotten about. The agreement with AOL Time Warner, if my memory serves me right, is that relative to the network itself, that we specifically told them they had to allow other ISPs to use their communication facilities. Now, when the administration of the FCC changed, people forgot about that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, as I recall, AOL wanted to get access to Time Warner's cable networks.
Right.
So they could, you know, because they understood they were basically selling modem time. And that market was going to go away because of broadband. They didn't want to get left behind by broadband. But they didn't quite have the insight to understand that. Well, really, all you have to do is provide a telnet interface to AOL, and then people will be able to access you regardless of who their ISP is, which is what happened. You know, and they thought somehow they had to own the pipe in order to, you know, in order to get bits through it. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, but as I said, a lot of people made a lot of money out of it.
Yeah.
And a lot of people lost their jobs when it failed.
Mm-hmm. But so there's no law against stupid. And
there's no law against
stupid.
Yeah. That's correct.
And a lot of these things that I've actually thought were incredibly stupid have turned out to be, you know, pretty significant successes. I remember when I first heard about Twitter, I was like, I can't say anything in 140 characters. How can that possibly succeed? But
yeah.
But you know, I mean, that's the thing. That's the thing about innovation is that people do. They come up with things that sound maybe crazy, but you know, a lot of it, but then it turns into Facebook or Google. So you got to let the experiments run.
I think one of the big, big problems of the environment we're in, the internet environment we're in now, is the complete loss of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
That's not something that the FCC is very well equipped to handle. That's a job that usually is the FTC's.
Well, and the FCC doesn't even have jurisdiction over the firms that are the major violators.
That's right. That's right. And so, yeah, the final comment on Title II, I could go on that for hours, but I won't, is that it was also quite strange that the White House basically told the FCC to go and do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's that type. They didn't quite order them to do it because they can't. But the tradition is that the FCC is an independent agency that's completely decoupled for good reason from the political process. And I think that's something that's worth.
Yeah, I mean, that is the rationale. But I agree with you that when the president of the United States makes a YouTube directed at the FCC that's ostensibly to express his opinion, his preference, or make a suggestion, it's very hard to distinguish a suggestion from an order when it's coming from the president of the United States and you're holding a job like Tom Wheeler was, where he was appointed by the president.
Yeah. Appointed by the president on a 5-year term, so he had mm-hmm. he had the ability to say no, but you know, that's a difficult thing to do. It's the same with the Congress. Now, I remember, sorry to tell those stories, but where the Congress and the FCC butted heads on something, the Congress has no authority over the FCC except their budget.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly there were no pencils at the FCC, there was paper shortage. Eventually they negotiated a rational thing, but it was done in a, we're separate. We're a separate independent agency, which I think is something very important to continue understanding. I think Pei knows that very well.
Yeah, well, and this is, that's a, it's a really, it's an unfortunate dynamic, because when the FCC does something that Congress doesn't approve of, Congress cuts their funding, which weakens the FCC and probably makes it more likely that they're going to do additional things that Congress doesn't agree with. I mean, for example, there's not a hell of a lot of engineering staff at the FCC these days, and not a hell of a lot of economic staff either. So the agency is kind of tilted. I think even, well, you were there in the mid-90s, and it wasn't really rich in internet talent then, and I don't know that it's may not be any better now. So,
go on.
And you have a suggestion for how to beef up the engineering expertise at the agency, right?
After I left in 2000, actually, I left. One of the observations that was crystal clear is that the commissioners had basically a very good set of lawyers working on their staff, but the number of engineering talent that understood the internet was maybe two or three within the whole FCC. And most of them did not have a way to interact with the commissioners. The quote, a floor, to use the FCC, which turns out to be on the seventh floor, but we won't go there.
Creative number.
And what I proposed, and I assume others proposed, is that every commissioner should add to their staff. Initially, it was a computer scientist. That got changed to an engineer, or computer scientist, basically somebody who understood technology.
Mm-hmm.
And that, so each commissioner would have one of these people, and that group of technologists would be in sort of a matrix organization with the chief technologist coordinating across the individual staff and technologists. That would create a marvelous mechanism for informing the commissioners, for the technologists themselves to come up with positions which they could try to deal with their own commissioners. I think both houses of the Congress basically had sponsors for that. There was a fair amount of enthusiasm. Mm-hmm.
Well, and some of the members of Congress actually have technical people on their staff, not necessarily in a permanent capacity, but I know a couple of people who have worked, you know, on a temporary basis with senators to just help them, you know, get their arms around some of these technical issues that are so important.
That's right. When I was chief technologist, I had some of that with the White House, with the Hale staff, mostly educational, but you know, also providing some information when requested.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be a little careful, because then again, the FCC is an independent agency. I have some beautiful stories about that, which I'd probably keep for another time.
So the... I think when you were there in the late 90s and in 2000, the chief economist and the chief, Jerry Fallhaber was the chief economist back then, right?
Right, right.
And so you two guys, I think, had a level of stature and influence that has not been typical of chief economists and chief technologists over the years. You know, some people have said that that you guys were effectively like the sixth and seventh commissioner. In the sense that, I mean, you had a lot of influence over the thinking of the agency itself, which I think is not commonly the case. In the early days, the commissioners of the FCC actually were technical people,
right?
But right. You know, it's shifted to where now they're, you know, they in many cases are you know, political players. They're there have been several Capitol Hill staff who were promoted to FCC commissioner spots that didn't really have any technical, you know, had were historians and had legal backgrounds and all that, but for whom the technical issues were, I think, a little bit hard to grasp.
Yeah, they certainly were, when I was there, they were very receptive to learning.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry Falhaber and I had a long history together for Bell Labs. And one of the things we could do, which turned out to be remarkably good, is that, you know, if you go and argue with the commission on a technical issue, you might get someplace. If you went and argued with them on an economic issue, you might get someplace. If we could agree on something and go and argue together, we almost always manage to win.
Hmm.
And that just happened, assuming there wasn't a political nightmare, which didn't happen that often. You could always win because you sort of took the two legs of the table and said, look, you need both legs. And then certainly in the 2000 area, 1999, 2000, the internet was just beginning to impact the FCC. I was the first chief technologist that could spell internet.
Well, I think I've heard you say there wasn't anybody at the FCC that knew how to spell IP.
Right. Well, that was the other problem, by the way. If you got into a discussion and you talk with saying IP, you had to be very careful that the person listening didn't assume you meant intellectual property.
Yeah, that happens
because,
a lot.
Because, again, lawyers, that happens a lot. But we haven't seen that, at least I have not seen that that collaboration. We've had some good chief technologists there. But, you know, not that many. And the ability to deal with the commission as a whole, I think, has been weakened through a set of historical things that happened after I was there. That I don't want to go into now, but I think to reestablish those as important things that, and then to provide the technical support staff across each commissioner would give a phenomenal boost to the FCC's ability to handle what's increasingly complex problems, and it ain't going to get any simpler.
Well, and I think it goes to restoring the balance. The, you know, the policy considerations, and the FCC is, you know, for better or for worse, has become a policy-making body and not simply an enforcement body. To have sound policy, it has to be grounded in both economics and technology, and the law doesn't necessarily provide us with a roadmap to good policy. It just tells us what the boundaries are on the agency's power. So, I mean, seems to have been reversed, where the rationale for Title II is that it's legally sustainable, so the FCC won't have to lose again in court. Didn't lose again in court after invoking Title II on internet service providers. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's good policy. It's just a winning legal strategy.
That's correct. I've always looked at the law as a mechanism to exercise good policy, and not vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we agree.
Yeah. So looks like we're going to have a. This net neutrality fight's a little bit different, I hope, than the previous ones, and that with any luck, and we can all just sort of agree, yeah, we're all fine with net neutrality. The question is, you know, Title II and this general conduct standard, which really gives the agency frightening power to essentially make it up as it goes along, which we'd probably rather not see.
I'd rather not see that. Yeah.
But I think to some extent where the parties are talking past each other, because you have one group that says they want net neutrality and the other group is saying, yes, but let's not do it with Title II.
As I have said often, those are two separate issues.
Mm-hmm.
No, and assuming I know what net neutrality is, there are a lot of ways to enforce net neutrality. I don't need Title II.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, at this point, we have John Oliver. I mean, you know, if someone does something bad, John Oliver will complain, and that'll be the end of it.
That'll be the end.
I think the FCC is sort of ancillary to HBO now.
That's damn near, if you look back at the Comcast thing, the noise that came out of in the ether about what Comcast was doing, assuming they were doing it, which in fact they weren't, but the noise was enough to really get Comcast to make it go away.
Mm-hmm.
Too much noise.
Yeah, they were doing some things that were fairly crude, but the thing that the FCC never did quite realize is what their motivation was. I mean, I don't want to relitigate that.
No.
But I've talked to the Comcast engineers who were involved in it and actually knew what was going on and why they did it, and this didn't necessarily get broadcast by the public relations folks over there, but they had a real problem to solve, and they were stuck between the equipment they had, which wasn't really adequate to do it, and the new equipment that was on order and the shipment had been delayed because of the DOCSIS 3 standard being slow to materialize. So they basically applied a Band-Aid that they knew was a Band-Aid, but it was just the best tool they had at the time. You know, they used it for, maybe 12, maybe 18 months in some places, and when their new equipment showed up, they, you know, didn't have to use it anymore.
Yeah. Well, part of the headache is that two things. One, Comcast has never been very good at explaining what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure anybody believes them anyway,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, companies that get in that position, that's another discussion. But things are going to change dramatically. The nightmares that IoT is going to produce in the privacy space. Now, is that, where does that fall in the jurisdictional thing with a Title II? I don't know.
Oh, and Title II is not that. It somehow Google was going to be the savior of broadband networking in the U.S. And they, after Title II was passed, Google decided that they didn't want to play that game anymore.
Right, which is smart.
Yeah, I don't know if it's cause and effect, but it. I know Google was not happy about. They intentionally didn't implement any Title II services in their Kansas City network just because they didn't want to suffer the regulatory headache. So you couldn't get telephone service, you know, bundled with your Google Fiber in KC.
Yeah. Yes.
It does not ease the path to innovation. Well, great.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So I think that pretty well wraps it up.
Okay.
I appreciate your coming on the podcast again and helping to illuminate this thing. And I think I probably appreciate now more than ever that I don't mean to be too much of a suck up, but your tenure at the FCC, it was sort of a golden age for internet policy. And I think in many ways, if we could return to the kind of thinking that animated Chairman Kennard's FCC, we'd be in a much better place than we've been. And I hope Chairman Pai is going to be that kind of a chairman.
Yeah, I've met with him briefly. I haven't had a deep discussion with him. And he struck me as a smart guy who could end up doing things very well. You know, depends, as usual,
But, yeah, I mean, I think there's no question that he's really good at law. I mean, he's a lawyer by training.
Right.
Doesn't understand the technology and the economics as well as, you know, people who specialize in those fields do. But he also strikes me as someone that has a good sense of his limitations. So he doesn't try to substitute his judgment for that of, you know, competent engineers and economists, but he's open-minded and listens and learns. And I think more than anything else, he's got a good heart. And that'll get you a long way.
And if he, in fact, gets the support staff that he needs to make the technical and economic judgments within the FCC to rebuild that mechanism, which has been sort of fizzled away over the last couple of terms, I think that could give him a major amount of future.
Yeah, and a lot of that comes down to budget. It's just like a lot of these things do, and I hope that he's able to develop that, you know, collegial mutual trust kind of relationship with Congress and get us further down the road.
I hope so.
Okay.
Okay,
well,
sir.
There we have it. This has been the High Tech Forum podcast. And folks, if you listen to this on iTunes, you know, give us a recommendation. If you listen to it from the blog, feel free to leave comments. And our Twitter handle is High Tech Forum. We do these podcasts at least once a month, sometimes more frequently. And I think probably for the next couple of ones are going to be on this theme about the activity that's pending at the Federal Communications Commission and what that means for the future of the Internet. So glad to have you listen. And once again, I'm Richard Bennett and signing off.